There exists a studying and learning system known as the Feynman technique, named after the brilliant physicist Richard Feynman, or Feynman. I say Feynman. The four methods in the technique go as follows. Pretend to teach the concept as you would to someone who has a little background knowledge on that concept. Identify gaps in your explanations of that concept. Organize and simplify your explanation and understanding of the concept. And most importantly, transmit or communicate the subject to an audience or to those that may not have a significant background in the concept. In this chapter, I will be attempting to apply the Feynman technique through calculus, where I will communicate the basics, and even some of the not-so-basics, of such a concept. In this chapter, calculus and the basic operations, such as limits, derivatives, integrals, and differential equations, will be introduced and understood. I plan to follow in the footsteps of Sal Khan, the leader of Khan Academy, the founder of Khan Academy, and give abstract definitions of the topics whilst explaining them in detail. For his videos on calculus really helped me learn it throughout the last month because I'm skipping Calc AB to go to BC, and I want to learn AB first, and I also want to learn BC. I'm already doing BC, and I want to do Calc 3. Calculus is extremely fun, let's just say it that way. And you'll see how it's so fun in these next two episodes, because this also is a two-part series, mini-series, sub-series. The origin of calculus is almost universally known, for its hearth is associated with the greatest scientist, arguably, in human history, Isaac Newton. With another mathematician, Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz, Newton invented what is known as infinitesimal calculus, or calculus. If you know the operations in calculus, you probably understand why calculus is formally called infinitesimal calculus. This history of calculus, while being very well known, is not complete. For some of the ideas of calculus arose long before Isaac Newton's mathematical reign. Long before Newton, ancient Egyptians developed many of the ideas of integral calculus, which is the accumulation of change. And of course, we will discuss that later in the chapter, in the episode, in the double episode. A papyrus, I believe it's called, from ancient Egypt, from the 19th century BCE, known as the Moscow Papyrus, details the calculations of both volume and area, both of which are goals of integral calculus, but they do not indicate method. Even so, area is an integral part of integral calculus, pun intended. The ancient Greek mathematician Eudoxus, I may be butchering his name, used a method known as the method of exhaustion in order to calculate areas and volumes. Now, areas and volumes of curved surfaces that are not necessarily spheres, that are not necessarily defined, we generally will find the integral of a specific finite interval of that particular solid or object. Now, this method, known as the method of exhaustion, resembled the limit, which is the very fundamental operation in calculus. It's the very fundamental thing in calculus outside of maybe functions. This method evolved into heuristics, akin to approximations, which were similar to methods applied in integral calculus. Mathematicians of the pre-Newton eon would continue to craft methods that resembled calculus. For example, the Arab mathematician Alhazen derived a formula for the sum of fourth powers, which not only resembled integration, but was integration. Even Johannes Kepler, the father of the laws of planetary motion, in his work Stereometria Doliorum Vinariorum, translating to the volume of a wine barrel, Kepler developed a basis for calculus, where he calculated the area of an ellipse by finding the sum of its radii and integral sum. They're similar. Even the second fundamental theorem of calculus, which states that the integral of a function over a defined integral or interval can be used by calculating the antiderivative of the function and applying the antiderivative to the interval. Okay, that sounds like Greek to anyone that does not know calculus yet. So basically, we'll get to it. But even that, a very fundamental theorem of calculus, considering it's literally called it a fundamental theorem of calculus, was proven by Isaac Barrow and James Gregory around 1670, which was around the time that Isaac Newton himself was developing calculus. The two main players in the game of course, going into the actual legitimate history of the study of calculus and all that, the two main players in that game were Isaac Newton, of course, and Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz. Isaac Newton quickly developed derivatives and its rules, such as the product rule and the chain rule, in order to discover laws of gravity and of motion, which were detailed in his most famous work, known as Philosophy Naturalis Principia Mathematica. Even though he was British and spoke English, yes, Latin. Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz, on the other hand, was far more concerned with the formalisms of mathematics, and thus he spent a lot of time creating the notation for operations in calculus. Leibniz is credited with the notion of higher derivatives, so second, third, fourth derivatives, those are interesting, and the product and chain rules in both their differential and integral forms. Newton and Leibniz discovered calculus independently of one another, and thus the two are both considered co-founders of calculus, even though Isaac Newton thought he was being cheated out of the credit for discovering quote-unquote calculus when it was found out that Leibniz was basically stealing his work because they had the same things. They were developing the exact same things with different notation. That's basically what was happening. And it was later confirmed that Isaac Newton did not discover it on his own necessarily. He did, but they were discovered, and calculus was discovered independently in two different places, essentially. Calculus would be developed further by characters such as Bernard Riemann, who created the Riemann sum, which is one of the fundamental things you'll learn in calculus even before you learn about the actual definite integral or even the indefinite integral. And honestly, I do not like Riemann sums. Karl Weierstrass, Augustine Louis or Louis Cauchy, Colin Maclaurin, that Maclaurin series, that's a big part of calculus as well. Brooke Taylor, and Maria Gaetana Agnesi, among many others, of course. It's still continuing to develop, so there are obviously a significant number of players in that game of calculus. Now, calculus itself is known as the study of continuous change, which is often referred to as calculus of infinitesimals, where infinitesimals are numbers that are much closer to zero than any standard real number, but are not, of course, quite zero. For example, an infinitesimal number may be represented as the x value in the function ln of x, so the natural log of x. For example, when y equals negative 1 followed by, that has to be 23 zeros, x is extraordinarily close to zero. Yes. Because that's basically how the function goes. Ln of x, the natural log of x. It's basically I guess I could really say it's almost a curved capital gamma. So like a curved upside down and to the right L. So and horizontally flipped after it is vertically flipped. Essentially. Or actually, if it's vertically flipped, it would still be able to go to the right. So never mind. But that's essentially technically going even further, infinitesimally small, you get to an infinitesimal number. And of course, an infinitesimal number in the function, the natural log of x, is an infinitely small value of x that is not zero. For zero is, of course, unreachable in the function ln of x. And of course, the natural log of x is e to the power of x of anything excluding zero equals zero, of course. But yeah. The two major branches of calculus, which are to be discussed later in the chapter, are integral calculus and differential calculus. Integral calculus pertains to the accumulation of change in the area under curves and many other things, area, volume, all that. An example, this would be like, for example, the area of the function of x when the function of x equals x cubed plus 5x plus 17. And if it were to be just an indefinite integral, you would have x to the fourth power over 4 plus 5 over 2x squared plus 17x plus c, with c being an arbitrary constant. I had to kind of do it in my head there. But let's just say there is a definite integral under that specific thing. You would have, if our bounds, our interval is from 4 to 11, the answer, and I'm not doing this one in my head, would be 3977.75. Now, you could apply 11 times 3 to the equation. You get like 1331 or something. And for x cubed plus 55 plus 17, so plus 72. And you get some random number, but it would be a whole number. So obviously there is something being done to that integral that we have to figure out. And we shall later in this episode, in these pairs of episodes, because that'll be next episode. Differential calculus pertains to instantaneous rates of change and the slopes of curves. For example, the function f of x equals x squared minus 4x plus 4 can be represented by its derivative equation, which is just 2x minus 4. Power rule, power rule, power rule. At x equals 47, the instantaneous rate of change of f of x would be 90. So f prime, or the derivative with respect to x at 47 of f of x would be 90. The two branches relate to one another through these fundamental theorems of calculus, notably the second fundamental theorem of calculus, which pertain to what I consider the antithesis nature of the integral and the derivative. They're not necessarily antitheses, but they technically are. They find different things, but they're also anti and not anti. An integral is often called an antiderivative. That's my example. Antiderivative. See where I got that analogy from? Well, functions, we're going to get into functions because functions are fundamental things in calculus, the very fundamental thing in calculus, to be honest. While functions are fundamental notions of math far less advanced than calculus, they remain fundamental notions of calculus. Not only is the function a fundamental notion of calculus, the function's development coincided with calculus's development in mathematics. Informally, a function f of x is often defined as an input-output machine, where any input x yields an output f of x, or often y. An example of a function is the function g of x equals x squared, where any input of x would yield an output f of x that is exactly equivalent to the square of that x value. So if we had 16, it would be 256, for example, or 15, it'd be 225, or 25, it'd be 625. That's 25, if x equals 25, f of x would equal 625, yeah. For example, and I gave an example, g of 13 equals 169, g of 12 equals 144. It's fun to do squares, but of course, as functions are basic, fundamental binary relations in all of mathematics, their explanations need not be made, though their connections to calculus are of course important. Functions are used quite literally everywhere in calculus. The fundamental notion of calculus itself is a limit, which grants a value of a function f of x as it approaches a value x. Functions define the limit, for the fundamental limits of calculus are defined through functions, if that made any sense. There exist numerous more uses of functions in calculus. They exist everywhere, literally. I mean, the only thing I can think of other than a function, but I have a very limited calculus background, is a sequence. Even so, functions are exceptionally important in mathematics and in calculus, of course. Some examples of functions in calculus include in derivatives and integrals, though there exist numerous other uses of functions in calculus. So they basically follow differential calculus and integral calculus. So they're parts of both. They're major parts of both. They're integral parts of both. Derivatives in differential calculus find the slope of a curved function at an instantaneous point. A linear function is a function whose highest degree is the zeroth, or the first power, not 1 over x, for 1 over x is the same as x to the negative first power, which you'll see is a curve. The linear function, on the other hand, is a straight line. Thus, the slope of its tangent line at any arbitrary x value will always be the same as the slope of its secant line, or of the function's line. On the other hand, a non-linear function is not a straight line. Instead, it is a curve. So formally, a nonlinear function is a function whose highest degree is not equal to 1 or 0, technically. This is technically not a complete definition, though, so be aware. for example, e to the power of x, definitely not a curve. Ln x, natural log of x, is definitely not a linear function. Sorry. Also, Euler's number to the power of x is not a linear function. It is a nonlinear function. So technically, that is not true. Technically, but also that is a logarithm, and logarithms deal with exponents. Ln is what you have to raise e to get that specific number. So ln of 2 would be e to the power of ln 2, or no, it wouldn't. It would be e to the power of ln whatever the answer is, basically. It would equal what you need to raise e to get that number. So if you had ln of 2, it would be e of e to the power of x equals 2, and then you just solve for x, and x would just be ln 2 equals x. But that's algebra. But that's essentially what it is. So technically, yes and no. Like 2 to the power of x, for example, that is also a curve. But even so, technically, that's still to the power above 1. But even, we're just not going to worry about that. Don't worry too much about that definition. But that is essentially similar to what we're talking about. But for example, a nonlinear curve, an example of the nonlinear curve would be the function f of x equals x to the fourth power minus x to the second power, x squared, where the slope of the tangent line at an arbitrary point A is different from the slope of the tangent line at an arbitrary point B, as long as A does not equal B. Derivatives attack the instantaneous rates of change in both linear and nonlinear functions, but they are far more useful in ascertaining the slope of the tangent line at a particular point in a nonlinear function. Functions are also occurring often everywhere in integrals. Integrals assess the accumulation of change in functions. For example, the Riemann sum is a method of approximating the integral of a function under specified bounds by creating a finite number of rectangles. This is specifically with a function, curve, in the case of a curve function, of course, under the curve of a function when its x values are greater than 0, and above the curve of a function when its y values are, sorry, when its y values are greater than 0, so it'd be under the curve of a function when its y values are greater than 0, and above the curve of a function when its y values, when that function's y values are less than 0. Theoretically, the more rectangles approximating the integral, the closer the value to the integral of the function under the specified bounds, though the approximation will only get infinitesimally close to the integral. The approximation will never be exactly the integral of the function, is basically what I'm saying. Indefinite integrals define functions through their antiderivatives, where many of the derivative formulae run the opposite direction, essentially. All of this may seem extremely abstract right now, but again, bear with me, and it will be more understandable as we go on. And if you're really having trouble, which I'm sure it's not the easiest thing to learn it, to learn something, all this stuff, all of calculus mathematically in 2 episodes in an hour, all I can say is put it at half speed. Put it at half speed and write it down. Writing it down really helps. But I'm also considering sending out the whole doc. Now, there are definitely some grammatical errors in the doc that I'm using to record this, but I'm considering sending a shareable link to the document that I used to create this episode, these 2 episodes, so that you guys can understand it more, because it's true mathematics and you need to see it. You need to see it. So I'm considering doing that, of course. Now, we're going to go to the limits now. Because, of course, limits are the fundamental things of calculus. Of course, they're one of the many fundamental things of calculus. The limit of a function f of x at an arbitrary value x is the value f of x approaches as it nears x, which is what we learned earlier. Limits are the fundamental notions of calculus, especially differential calculus, and are used to define, the notions of every major phenomenon in calculus, including continuation, differentiation, and integration. Formally, a function f of x's limit is defined as x approaches an arbitrary constant c. As x approaches c, f of x approaches an arbitrary constant l. So thus we could say that the limit of f of x as x approaches c, with a basically an arrow, is expressed as lim, L-I-M, where x is below it, x approaches c is below that word L-I-M, lim, of f of x equals L, where f of x approaches L as x approaches c. So to alleviate the abstract nature of arbitrary constants, which is always difficult, let's imagine the limit of a function when f of x equals x cubed minus 4x. Imagine the limit of f of x at x equals 11, formerly the limit as x approaches 11 of x cubed minus 4x, or of f of x. As x approaches 11, f of x equals 1287. So it would be 1331 minus 44, and that is very obviously 1287. Thus, the limit, formerly lim, as x approaches 11, where x approaches 11 is below that word lim, of x cubed minus 4x, or of f of x, equals 1287. Well, the case of f of x equals x cubed minus 4x is a grand example of a limitable function. There exist other functions with which a limit can be ascertained. Discontinuous functions are also definable in calculus. These discontinuous functions can include functions with discontinuities, non-infinite domains, and asymptotes. Limits can be defined at any place other than the points where a function is discontinuous, and they can even be defined with some guidelines in points where a function is discontinuous. Remember that a limit is an approximation, thus it need not be an actual value in a function at a particular point. Instead, the limit is the value of f of x at a point where x is infinitesimally close to an arbitrary constant c. So it need not be exactly at c, but nearing c from both sides, from the right side, from the left side, depending on the parameter that is set. Now, first we're going to discuss limits of functions with discontinuities. So suppose the function f of x is continuous at all points other than x equals 9. At x equals 9, the value f of x equals 97. Suppose f of x equals 21 at x equals 8, and f of x equals 29 at x equals 10. Venturing closer to x equals 9, we're supposed to find the limit of x equals 9 as x approaches 9. Let's say that f of x at 8.99999, when x is 8.9999, is 22.99, and f of x as at 9.0001 is 23.01. Even with the discontinuity, it can be reasonably ascertained by getting closer and closer that the limit as x approaches 9 of f of x equals 23, even when f of x or y equals 97 at x equals 9. So in a general form, consider the function f of x is continuous at all x values other than x equals c, where c is of course an arbitrary constant. At x equals c, f of x equals f of c, but as x approaches c, f of x approaches k, where k is another arbitrary constant with a parameter that k does not equal f of c. The limit of x as it approaches c is still k, for the values that progress infinitely closer to x equals c progress infinitely closer to f of x equals k. Thus, the limit as x approaches c of f of x equals k, not f of c. Suppose the function psi of x is a piecewise function, where the function, we have to kind of go off on a tangent because this is another important one, where the function psi of x is x squared at x values less than or equal to 2, so negative infinity to exactly 2, so open parentheses or open bound to closed bound, and is x to the fourth power at x values greater than 2, so not at 2, but only greater than 2, so open bound 2 to infinity. At x equals 2, the limit of the function of x squared would be 4, whereas the limit of the function x to the fourth power would be 16. There obviously exists a discontinuity in this piecewise function, and we technically cannot get the limit from both sides as they approach x equals 2. Thus, specific parameters will need to be established. A one-sided limit is the limit of the function psi of x, for example, as x approaches c from either the right or the left side, When it approaches from the left, the value x approaches what the value x approaches will be represented with a negative side. The value x approaches will be represented with a negative side when x approaches c from the right, it will be represented with a plus sign. In our function psi of x, the limit as x approaches 2 from the left is 4. Obviously, the limit as x approaches 2 of psi of x from the left is 4, equals 4. And the limit as x approaches 2 from the right is 16, because 2 to the 4th power is 16. 2 squared, 4. 2 cubed, 8. 2 4th, 16. Now, not every function in the world has an infinite domain. So let's suppose the function f of x is defined at all x values greater than but not equal to 0. I would have used the natural log of x for this because its domain is 0 to infinity, where 0 is not included in the domain, but I kind of have to use it for specifically for the asymptotes. But let's suppose the function is defined at all x values greater than but not equal to 0, so it's 0 to infinity, open bound. Suppose that f of x equals x squared plus 14x plus 17. Let's say that we want to find the limit of f of x as x approaches 0. I would assume that alarm bells would be ringing wild in your head right now, for x is not defined at 0. It's an open interval represented by parentheses, indicates that the left or right parameter is not included in the domain of the function. So basically the open interval, so left, in this situation, the left bound, it's not included. And infinity is technically not included either, but infinity is arguably not a number. Even with the restriction on the domain, though, we can still figure out what x is as it approaches infinitely closer to 0. One thing must be defined before we take the limit of x as x approaches 0, a limit of f of x as x approaches 0. As the domain of the function is only positive, and as we are attempting to take the limit of an x value where only values to the right of that value are defined, we must set a parameter on the limit itself. As was said earlier, with functions with discontinuities, we can obtain different limits of the same x value depending on whether we take the limit of x as x approaches c from the left or the right side of the value x. If we take the limit as x approaches 0 from the left side, the limit of f of x as x approaches 0 from the left side or from the negative side is undefined because there's no value. Our value is undefined, of course. However, if we plug in the limit as x approaches 0 from the right side, a value is given. Let's now plug in the limit as x approaches 0 of x squared plus 14x plus 17. 0 squared is 0, 14 times 0 is 0, 17 times 17 times, kidding, 17 times 1, or 17 times nothing, is 17. So thus our value is 17. For 0 squared plus 14 times 0 plus 17 equals 17. So thus the limit as x approaches 0 from the right side of x squared plus 14x plus 17 equals 17. Suppose that we have the function f of x equals 1 over x. Let's say that we are asked to find two limits, the limit of f of x as x approaches 0 and the limit of f of x as x approaches infinity. To understand the two limits we must take, it is important that we understand the function f of x on a graph. There exist four asymptotes in the function f of x equals 1 over x. These asymptotes occur as x approaches 0 from the left. So if you think about it, 1 over negative 0.00000001 is a ridiculously high number. So obviously it's going up to infinity. And then this same thing happens on the right. They basically are horizontal mirrors of one another, where if you were to approach it from the right, you would get 1 over point. You would get, okay, so in this situation, actually, from the left side, you'd be going extremely down to negative infinity. And on the right side, you'd be going up to positive infinity. Thus, if you were to do 1 over 0.001, it's 1,000. So that can tell you something right there. It just keeps going up. Now, of course, as the two approach infinity, though, as x approaches infinity and negative infinity, both times they approach 0. On the left side, or on the negative side, it's approaching zero from below the x-axis, and on the right, or the positive side, it's approaching zero from, y is approaching zero, or f of x is approaching zero from the positive side. So the first limit we are asked to take is the limit of f of x as x approaches zero. Now let's assume that we are supposed to take the limit of f of x as x approaches zero from the right side, so that would be x approaches zero, positive, whatever. If this is the case, let's imagine progressively lesser values for x. When x equals 0.1, f of 0.1 is 10. When x equals 0.01, f of 0.01 is 100, and so on. Because of the fact that from the right side of 0, the value for f for x can never be negative, it can be reasonably assumed that there exists an asymptote as x approaches 0. Thus, the limit of 1 over x as x approaches 0 from the right side is infinity. If we approach x equals 0 from the left side, the direct opposite would happen. So, like, f of negative 0.01 is negative 100. Thus, the limit as x approaches 0 from the left side of 1 over x is equal to negative infinity. The second limit we are asked to take is the limit of f of x as x approaches infinity. In the case of f of x equals 1 over x, whether we are asked to take the limit of positive infinity or negative infinity does not matter, specifically for this function, for the limit of both values are the same. They just come from different, from above or below the x-axis. As I'm sure is easy to see, the increase in x values, for example, when f of x is, when x equals 1,000, f of x equals 0.001. And at x equals 10,000, it's 0.0001, and so on. So as I'm sure it's easy to see, the increase in x values and the positive side of the graph yields an f of x that is progressively nearer to zero. And the decrease in x values on the negative side of the graph yields an f of x that is progressively nearer to zero. Thus, the limit as the limit of x as it approaches infinity of 1 of x equals 0, and the limit as x approaches negative infinity of 1 over x equals 0. Suppose we have a function f of x that is defined at all x values excluding x equals 3. Let's say that f of x equals x squared minus 9, which is a difference of perfect squares, hint, 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 divided by x minus 3. If we were to take the limit as x approaches 3 of f of x, I'm sure that some of you would be perplexed. Applying 3 to x gives 9 minus 9 over 3 minus 3, which is 0 over 0, which is undefined, but I'm going to say indeterminate, hint, hint, hint. Even more perplexing is the fact that this limit can be taken, hint. In calculus, L'Hôpital's rule states that an answer of 0 divided by 0 means that the limit can still exist, but maneuvers must be taken. Some of you may have noticed x squared minus 9 is a difference of perfect squares, meaning that it is factorable. If one factors this difference of perfect squares, they obtain x plus 3 times x minus 3. As we are multiplying in the numerator, we can divide away x minus 3 because x minus 3 is in the denominator, and thus we are left with the limit of x as x approaches 3 of x plus 3. As a result, the limit of as x approaches 3 of x squared minus 9 divided by x minus 3 equals 6. And look at that. There's your answer. In terms of limits and derivatives, 0 divided by 0 is known as indeterminate form, meaning that the limit at a point where this value is obtained can still potentially be derived. However, if a value such as 1 over 0 or any value over 0 that's not 0 is obtained, then there exists no limit at the point given. An example is the limit as x approaches 3 of x plus 4 over x minus 3, where the answer is 7 over 0, and thus the algebraic limit at that point does not exist. Being that calculus is a massive field with a significant amount of information, the chapter on calculus will also be divided into two episodes for the third time straight. Where the first deals with the history of calculus, the formal definition of calculus, functions in calculus, and limits in calculus, and in the next episode, what will be discussed are derivatives, integrals, and differential equations. Anyway, thank you all for listening, and as always, have a good morning, afternoon, evening, and night. If you wish to support the podcast, click the support link in the description of this episode and subscribe. Subscribe, quote-unquote. Anyway, take care and stay curious.